Chapter 17 was the subject of a lengthy study over at least 2 weeks, and it will be useful to take a quick look back before we plunge into chapter 18. In chapter 17, we see that Job basically is lamenting his predicament. What is his predicament that causes him to mourn and grieve so much? It consists of the following characteristics, his predicament. Going in approximately chronological order, which is also a thematic order in this book, the sequence is as follows. There was first the loss of all his children, the loss of his servants, his material possessions, leading to his loss in status as a leading citizen. The second aspect of it is that this fall from grace was as sudden as it was unexpected. And to make it worse, for no apparent rhyme or reason. Third characteristic of his predicament, his once healthy body is now ravaged by disease, not only disease but a particularly painful and loathsome sort of disease. And then of course, to make matters worse, he is treated as an untouchable by the very society in which he had until recently been looked up as an honored citizen, being mocked even by his wife. Bear in mind that she never deserted him. There's no evidence that she did, but she certainly ridiculed him out of her frustration, not out of a wicked heart. At least that is my interpretation of it. Then, to make matters even worse, being condemned and scorned by his three very close friends who had come from afar, friends who should have known him better. And most painful to him, most painful of all, was being spurned by the very God he had loved and served all his life. Was it wrong for Job to seek the reason why? And it is worth spending a moment to consider this question, because we sometimes believe from the teaching we receive that we should accept whatever happened to us as coming from the hand of God and not seek to know why. I beg to differ. I believe that it is part of our human responsibility to exercise our minds and understanding as far as possible, as far as we are capable of doing so, as far as God allows it, to exercise our minds to try and figure out why is this happening to me. The reason is this: if you deny or frustrate yourself in asking why something unexpected has happened to you, you are going against what I believe is a very fundamental characteristic of human nature. All human beings are born with this certain set of innate characteristics, and this is one of them, the desire to make sense of the world around us, which is why when something unexpected happens, we are confused and troubled, and we like to sort it out, as it were, to figure out why it has happened. We cannot deny this and console ourselves by saying, God knows, I just accept it. If, and this is an important point I believe, if having searched the matter carefully to the best of our ability, if God does not give the understanding why something unexpected has happened to us, then it is fair enough to surrender it to God and say, Lord, I can't understand, I accept it. But that should not be our first line of response. Our first line of response is with our God-given ability and understanding, and with whatever spiritual maturity we have to make sense of the world around us. And this Job did. You can't fault him for that. Chapters 3 to 17 and indeed beyond therefore reveal the depth of this soul-searching by Job. He strives to understand why a loving God should have brought all this suffering and woe upon him. That in itself had been a traumatic experience for Job, because like his three friends, he was handicapped by a limited understanding of the law of double retribution, which I believe you know very well by now. And as you will recall, the error of the four of them, the three friends and Job, was to expect that this law of double retribution, nothing wrong with the law, to expect that this law of double retribution would be fully applied or exercised purely within the 70 years of earthly life. That is not necessarily the case. The fuller revelation of Scripture, and there are many passages, Psalm 73 is just one of them, make it clear that the wicked will never get away with it. The righteous will always and eventually be blessed, but on God's time frame. If you take a quick look at Psalm 73, reading from verses 12 onwards, "Behold, these are the ungodly who prosper in the world. They increase in riches." So writes Asaph the psalmist. "Verily, I have cleansed my heart in vain and washed my hands in innocency. For all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning." Verse 16. "When I thought to know this," there you have it, when he tried to make sense of this, "it was too painful for me until I went into the sanctuary of God, until I came into the presence of God. Then understood I their end. Surely thou," referring to God, "didst set them," the ungodly, who had appeared to be getting away with the best deal, "thou didst set them in slippery places. Thou castest them down into destruction. How are they brought into desolation? As in a moment, they are utterly consumed with terrors. As a dream when one awaketh, so, O Lord, when thou awakest, thou shalt despise their image." Meaning to say, when God awakes, that is to say, when the day of judgment comes, these people who appear to be getting away with it will get their just deserts. So we have essentially summarized the first 17 chapters in a matter of 5 or 6 minutes. Now we go on to chapter 18. 21 verses which break up into two parts. Verses 1 through 4 is Bildad's denunciation of Job. And in verses 5 through 21, Bildad's depiction of the terrors that are laid up in store for the ungodly. But this part is connected with the first part, a direct denunciation of Job. Because as you will see, in describing in general the terrors that are laid up for the ungodly, Bildad has given an implied and further criticism of Job, a very painful one at that. What sparked this off? Many factors, one of which surely, and surprisingly, one of which was Job's tendency to lapse into lengthy speeches. And it appears that this had irritated Bildad. But not only because of the long and lengthy speeches of Job, but the content of those speeches, which very often constituted a criticism of the three of them. What Bildad failed to realize is that Job was not attacking them. He was trying to work through his immense spiritual and emotional trauma. And in the process of doing that, any reasonable human being would express ideas, feelings and emotions that can, if taken out of context, be very awkward or even painful to the person who hears it. But bear in mind that no one before or since has been called upon to suffer like Job. And the only way that he or any one of us in a similar situation can cope with that situation is to come to terms with it. And coming to terms with it does involve this process of working through. And therefore we will see Job sometimes his spirits are raised where he expresses his hope and confidence in God. At other times he seems to lose hope altogether and we see him plunged into the depths of despair. Nothing wrong with him, nothing wrong with his faith. It is the natural outward expression of this working out process by which any human being would come to terms with a difficult situation. You can't, ultimately, you cannot bottle it all up inside. If you are to survive, you have to come to terms with it. To come to terms with a difficult situation, you have to work through it and make some sense out of it. Bear in mind that Job was never set out to condemn his friends. But the problem with Bildad is, as you may recall from an earlier lesson, of the three of them, Bildad had a particularly legalistic and rigid mind. And to somebody like that, who would tend to take words at face value, Job's speeches must have come across as a direct criticism attacking himself and his two companions. And that certainly provoked Bildad. And once provoked, he attacks. And he attacks Job on two levels. The first is a frontal attack, which is verses 1 through 4. That is a direct and open denunciation of Job. And a more subtle attack follows in verses 5 to 21. And Bildad does that by depicting the terrors that are reserved for the ungodly. Why say that to Job unless Bildad is implying that Job is one of those ungodly people and therefore watch out, these terrors are reserved for you, my friend. Verses 1 through 4, then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said, how long will it be ere ye make an end of words? Mark, and afterwards we will speak. Wherefore are we counted as beasts and reputed vile in your sight? I leave verse 4 out for the moment. How long will it be ere ye make an end of words? Mark, pay attention, and afterwards we will speak. So this is a clear indication that Job's lengthy speeches had irritated Bildad. Bildad appears to have subscribed to a principle that is most clearly enunciated in the Epistle of James in chapter 1, verse 26. If any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, this man's religion is vain. Applied to Job, the conclusion for a person like Bildad would be, because he is indulging so often in these wordy speeches, that itself must be an indication that our friend here is guilty of some secret sin. Because, as James says, if a person speaks too much and doesn't control his tongue, then that man's religion is actually vanity. So that is Bildad's excuse for attacking Job. But as mentioned, Job is doing nothing more or less than coming to terms with his intense mental, emotional and spiritual anguish. Bildad could never understand that. Verse 3 gives the game away because it is a clearest indication of the factor that had most provoked Bildad. What does verse 3 say? Bildad complains to Job, "Why do you compare or regard us as beasts and therefore denigrate us in your sight?" So his sense of worth, Bildad's sense of worth, had been compromised by some of Job's criticisms, and that is another reason why he has gone on the attack against Job. This comparison with beasts can be understood by looking at some of the passages in Scripture, particularly the Old Testament. We will find that in those, it was customary then to emphasize the lack of perception in a human being by comparing him with a beast. Like one example among many, Psalm 73 again, verse 22, as Asaph says of himself, "So foolish was I and ignorant, I was as a beast." So in comparing, in the implied comparison of the three friends with beasts, insofar as they seem to lack understanding of the situation, Bildad took it to mean that Job was running them down, which was never Job's intention at all. Verse 4, "He teareth himself in his anger. Shall the earth be forsaken for thee, and shall the rock be removed out of its place?" The first question that leaps up at us is, who is Bildad addressing? He's addressing somebody, because he starts off by saying, "He teareth himself in his anger." Who is the he? Clearly, Bildad is addressing Job. He cannot be addressing anybody else, certainly not God. He is addressing Job. What is the implication of this form of address? To appreciate that, we must realize that this particular form of address, which is rendered in the Authorized Version as "he teareth himself in his anger," could be rendered in one of two ways. And how we understand, how well we understand the passage depends on which of these two ways we adopt. The first way is to read it as follows: "O thou who teareth thyself in his anger." O thou who teareth thyself in his anger. That's one way of rendering this first half. The other way is slightly different, but pay attention to the differences. "Thou art he that teareth thyself in his anger." Clearly there is a difference. Now we have to put our finger on what is the difference. The first rendition goes like this: "O thou who teareth thyself." The second goes thus: "Thou art he who teareth himself," and so on and so on. The general sense is the same, but there is a profound difference between these two forms of address. Wherein lies the difference? "O thou who teareth thyself in thy anger." It is what is called a subjective form of address, where the emphasis is muted. It is there, but it is not forceful at all. The second form of address: "Thou art he who teareth himself in his anger." The second form of address is what is called objective. And the difference is that in the second form of address, the emphasis is immeasurably stronger. I submit that in this context, it is the second form of address that is applicable. Bildad is virtually pointing the finger at Job and saying, you are the fellow who is tearing himself in his anger. Not anybody else, not God, don't blame God. You are the one. So it is that kind of emphasis which the poet, the writer of the book of Job, wants to convey, and he conveys that by this choice of phrasing, which is called an objective form of address. Thou art he who teareth himself in his anger. The KJV puts it in this form, he teareth himself in his anger, but we must be aware that it is an objective and emphatic form of address. The second half of the verse, shall the earth be forsaken for thee, and shall the rock be removed out of its place, will lead to a fascinating discussion. So please bear with me on this. We start off in a very straightforward way. What does the word forsaken mean? In the Hebrew, it is ozab. It means to be abandoned. One of the best ways of understanding the meanings of words, particularly in the Old Testament Hebrew, is to look at the comparative usage of such words. So to understand the meaning of ozab, which we say in English is abandoned, let's look at a comparable usage, and we will find one such in 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 6. I'm reading extracts from the verse, not the entire verse. So the king appointed unto the woman a certain officer, saying, restore all that was hers since the day that she left Ozab, abandoned the land, even until now. So it is now very clear what this Ozab means. It is the whole earth being forsaken or abandoned by God. Not being made desolate. That's a different Hebrew word for being made desolate. Here it is simply being abandoned, chucked to one side by God. As for the rock being moved out of his place, shall the rock be removed out of his place? It's the second part of that verse. This is suggestive of an earthquake, and certainly earthquakes are among the most spectacular of the forces of nature. So what is Bildad's point in verse 4? To appreciate that, we have to go back and recap what is Bildad's perspective. Bildad has all along been arguing from this standpoint that Job, given the fact that so many and so terrible afflictions have come upon him, it can only mean that Job, though he appeared to be an upright and godly man, has been harboring secret sins. It cannot be any other than that, because God is a law-giving and a law-abiding God. He has his laws, and he certainly abides by his own laws. And among those laws is this law of double retribution, which according to Bildad, and he was not quite correct in this, according to Bildad is very simple and very brutal. The righteous are always blessed in this life. The ungodly are always cursed again in this life. That part of it is not quite right, but that anyway is Bildad's perspective. So Bildad is convinced that Job has secret sin in his life. Therefore, for Job now, in the midst of his just reward, his sufferings which he deserves, according to Bildad, for Job now to ask God to acquit him, declare him not guilty, or even to give him a temporary reprieve from his suffering would be equivalent to asking God to turn the world upside down, because you basically are asking God to set aside his own laws. His law of double retribution is not framed by man, it was framed by God. So Bildad believes that Job, in asking for an acquittal, is tantamount to asking God to go against his own laws, which means basically turning the whole system of the world upside down. And it is that which he is trying to convey in poetic form in verse 4. According to Bildad, God, as a law-giving and law-abiding God, would never act in so capricious a manner. Well, the word capricious really is Bildad's way of looking at it. But there's a very interesting question that is buried in this passage. And the question is this. Bildad has raised the issue that in certain circumstances, for God to appear to go against his own law would entail an upheaval in the way the world is run. And Bildad, with his rigid legalistic mind, maintains that God never will act like that. God defines the laws and he religiously and literally and strictly abides by those laws. No exceptions, no special cases. The point is this. Is it possible that there are certain special cases in which God would appear to go against his own law and thereby would appear to overturn the world? You need to think carefully, because if you take it at face value, the tendency is to answer, no, it'll never happen. But I suggest that there is at least one situation in which God, maybe not literally, but in effect, has to turn upside down the way the world operates. And he does that whenever he saves an individual human being. If you think carefully about it, the sin of man merits no hope of salvation. Really, going by the same laws that this unchanging God has defined, the nature of sin in human beings is such that there is no logical, legal way in which God can rescue, deliver, exonerate the sinner. To do so would require turning the system of the world, at least in the case of that individual, upside down. But that is the extent to which God goes in order to save a human being. And it is this which is contained in John 3:16. For God so loved the world. It is a love that you and I and no believer can ever comprehend. A love which drives God apparently to turn the world upside down just in order to save one individual who, by his standards, legally, is not worth saving. It is a reminder to us, therefore, how great a debtor we are to grace. In the words of the familiar hymn, "O to grace, how great a debtor daily we are constrained to be." In the second part of chapter 18, verses 5 to 21, we see Bildad shifting his focus away from God to a more general case, the fate of the unrepentant sinner. But bear in mind that this generalized discussion is really an implied criticism of Job. What does he have to say? Bildad's depiction of the sinner, we have said, is an implied criticism of Job. And therefore, really, it is inappropriate. However, if you take verses 5 to 21 as representing the case of sinners generally, then what Bildad has to say doesn't go against the scriptures. It really is very much in keeping with the letter and spirit of the scriptures. So what exactly does Bildad have to say? It can be broken up into three parts logically. There is a premise, there is a body of the argument, and there is a conclusion. The premise that Bildad enunciates is in verses 5 and 6. Yea, the light of the wicked shall be put out, and the spark of his fire shall not shine. The light shall be dark in his tabernacle, and his candle shall be put out with him. Before we go into a discussion of these words, of these verses, does something stand out as you read these two verses? The light of the wicked shall be put out, the spark of his fire shall not shine, the light shall be dark in his tabernacle, his candle shall be put out with him. Do you see there a very beautiful illustration of one of the outstanding features of Hebrew poetry, which is parallelism? And in this case, clearly, it is synonymous parallelism. The body of the argument is in verses 7 to 20, and the conclusion, of course, is verse 21. The body of the argument, verses 7 through 20, depicts the sinner first caught in his sin and then overtaken by disaster, which not only engulfs him, but all those who are related or connected in any way with him. So we shall take this verse by verse. Because of its highly poetic content, full of imagery, with a general understanding of the passage which we have just discussed, the structure of it has been made clear to you. To understand it fully, we have no choice but to go verse by verse. So bear with me. Verse chapter 18, verse 7. The steps of his strength shall be straightened, hampered, limited, and his own counsel shall cast him down. Remember, Bildad in this passage, verses 7 to 20, is giving a general depiction of what happens to an unrepentant sinner. He's implying that Job is one of those. And he's wrong in that, of course. What does verse 7 mean? It means this: the steps of his strength, the free course of that person's life, shall suddenly be restricted, for example, by loss of prosperity, shall suddenly be restricted, and that person's plans and schemes shall be the very means of his downfall. Certainly, this is true of the ungodly. Psalm 73 makes it clear, they are caught in their own trap. Verse 8, for he, the sinner, is cast into a net by his own feet, and he walketh upon a snare, the snare referring to a deep ditch dug in the ground, covered with branches and leaves, the kind of pit into which the brothers threw Joseph. The sinner walketh upon a snare, and obviously falls right in, meaning to say he shall bring ruin upon himself even while he is going about plotting the downfall of others. Psalm 9 verse 16, the Lord is known by the judgment which he executeth. The wicked, as a result of that judgment, the wicked is snared not in anything that God has laid out as a trap for him, but God uses the devices and schemes of the wicked to trap the wicked directly. Verse 9, the gin, which is again a trap for wild animals or for birds, shall take him by the heel like a bear trap, and the robber shall prevail against him. Meaning to say that even if the wicked man should escape this trap, he would be dispossessed of all that he has by robbers, which means, if you look at the ultimate meaning of this verse, it is this: destruction in its many forms will come upon the unrepentant sinner without warning. And verse 10 reinforces that point that has just been made. The snare is laid for him in the ground and a trap for him in the way, whereby he is taken by surprise. Verse 11, the terrors shall make him afraid on every side and shall drive him to his feet, meaning to say he shall constantly be distressed by alarms, on account of which he would have no lasting peace or rest. Compare Proverbs 28 verse 1, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. This is a characteristic of the wicked. I'm reminded of Proverbs, I believe it is the last verse of chapter 1, whoso hearkeneth unto me, that is whosoever is godly and righteous, whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be free from all fear of evil. I'm recalling it from memory, but it comes to mind as an illustration of this point, that a truly godly person has nothing to be distressed about. Even if unpleasant circumstances do happen, he is prepared for it. He's ready for it because he knows he is in the hollow of God's hand. With Christ in the vessel, can we not smile at the storm? For the wicked, on the other hand, where he is completely reliant on his own intelligence, his skill, his wit to survive, he never knows when things will go against him, who may really be against him. So really, if you look below the surface, the wicked person has no peace or rest. He is constantly troubled by all of these fears and doubts, always having to look over his shoulder, always having to guard himself. And that really is his problem, because it is a result of the kind of lifestyle that he chose. Verse 12, his strength shall be hunger-bitten, and destruction shall be ready at his side. Hunger-bitten sounds like the kind of word that if you use in a GP essay might get you an A. Meaning of it is, he shall be depleted of strength by hunger. When you put it in poetic form, it sounds so much nicer. But it really means his strength shall be wasted away by hunger, by famine, and by misfortunes that come upon him like a hydraulic press to crush him in. So on the one hand, his internal strength, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, is wasted away by deprivation, and the troubles that happen to him from the outside are like the jaws of a hydraulic press that squeeze him more and more tightly and at some point crush his ribs in. That is a very graphic picture of what will happen to the ungodly. Verse 13, it shall devour the strength of his skin, even the firstborn of death shall devour his strength. I can guarantee that if you read this at one go, it will not make sense. So there are a few things we need to understand, few words we need to understand to grasp the meaning of this verse. Verse 13, first and foremost, it shall devour the strength of his skin. What does the it refer to? if you look at the context, there's only one object to which the it can refer, and the it has to refer to an expression that occurs in the second half of that verse. The second half of the verse refers to the firstborn of death devouring his strength. So again, this is synonymous parallelism. So verse 13 is saying that the firstborn of death shall devour his strength completely. The strength of his skin means every bit of strength shall be consumed. By what? By something which the writer calls the firstborn of death. So now we need to figure out what is the meaning of the expression the firstborn of death. And for that, we need to know, study a bit of ancient anthropology. In the ancient Near East, disease was regarded as the offspring of death. This is a perspective that is actually consonant with biblical teaching. As Milton put it in his great epic poem, Paradise Lost, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe. So really, disease, which is part of the woe, is the offspring, it is engendered, it is brought about by death, and death is brought about by sin. Among the Babylonians and the Assyrians, the god of plagues, who was known as Namtaru, N-A-M-T-A-R-U, was regarded as the chief court official of the Queen of Hell. So it was a very close connection which the ancient peoples made between disease, and of course they had no concept that germs were, bacteria and viruses were the root cause of disease, at least as far as humanity is concerned. They had no concept, the germ theory of disease only came about with the work of Pasteur in the mid-19th century. So until then, nobody had a clue as to what caused disease. So that does not detract from the power and strength of the imagery, wherein disease is regarded as the offspring of death. Because yes, really, disease, if untreated or unchecked, will lead to death. And in particular, there is one form of disease that may be singled out in this expression, the firstborn of death. What is that disease? It is that disease which was most feared in the ancient world. If you'd like to take a guess at naming that disease, the one disease which was most feared in the ancient world, it certainly wasn't the common cold, as it may be today. It certainly wasn't AIDS, it certainly wasn't bird flu, it was the bubonic plague spread by rats. This was the one disease that was the most feared. So it's entirely possible that it is this particular disease that is referenced in the phrase the firstborn of death. But in general, firstborn of death refers to disease, bearing in mind the ancient concept of disease as the offspring of death. So putting all this together, we arrive at the general sense of verse 13, which is as follows. The body of the wicked shall be ravaged by disease and thus be reduced to skin and bones, a condition as close as the living can get to death. If you look at it in that way, do you not see Bildad hitting out at Job? Because it is Job whose body has now been ravaged by disease, who has been reduced to skin and bones, and is about as close to death as it is possible for a human being to get. So really, our friend Bildad, in his general depiction of the terrors that await the ungodly, and he's not wrong in that sense. As a general depiction, much of what he says is true, but he is giving it as a further and a thinly veiled criticism of Job, and in that he is not right at all. He is not fair. Verse 14 continues the same vein of thought. His confidence, the confidence of the wicked, shall be rooted out of his tabernacle, and it shall bring him, that is to say, he shall be brought to the king of terrors. Again, a first reading of this verse would not make sense at all, because we do not know at the outset what is the meaning of the phrase the king of terrors. So we have to go delve into the meaning of that particular phrase. First half is clear. It means the home of the wicked shall no longer experience security and stability. It's the second half that is troubling, confusing. What is the king of terrors? Go back to what was said a moment ago, that disease is the offspring of death. If that be the case, then the king of terrors has to refer to death itself, but death as personified by a specific fallen angel. Death as personified, as represented by a particular fallen angel. The fallen angel whose name is given in Revelation 9:11 as Abaddon in the Hebrew, Apollyon in the Greek. And we today would identify him with the great deceiver of mankind, Satan. Revelation 9:11 reads, "And they," referring to the locusts, "had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit," angel of death, "whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon," meaning destruction, "but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon," which also means destruction. And as mentioned, we Christians would identify with Satan. Now this all begins to come together, because cast your mind back to Job chapters 1 and 2. Was it not Satan, this angel of death, this Abaddon or Apollyon, was it not Satan who went to God and asked for permission to strike Job down to the uttermost? And Job and God said, "You may do all, I give him into your hands, except you may not touch his life." Job chapter 2, verses 4 through 6. "And Satan answered the Lord and said, Skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath shall he give for, will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now, and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face." Verse 6. "And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in thine hand. You can do whatever you like with him, but save his life." So really, it was this angel of death, Satan, who through the relentless application of disease and suffering had brought Job to the brink of death. Verse 15, "It," a sense of being forsaken, "shall dwell in his tabernacle, in his home, because it is none of his. Brimstone," meaning sulfur, which is symbolic of utter desolation, "shall be scattered upon his habitation." That is poetry. The meaning of it is this: the home of the sinner, the dwelling place of the sinner, shall be abandoned, never again to be tenanted. It shall become like a haunted house. Verses 16 and 17 together: "His root shall be dried up beneath, and above shall his branch be cut off. His remembrance shall perish from the earth, and he shall have no name in the street." Meaning is as follows: the wicked will end up as a tree that is dead, his lineage, his family line shall be wiped out. His name and that of his family will cease to be remembered. And this last aspect was a very important consideration to the ancient folk. It was a terrible judgment upon any one of them to be told that your family line will be wiped out. And we see this very graphically illustrated in the behavior of King Saul. How he tried to get rid of David because he saw David as a threat to his dynasty. So among the ancient people, this desire to preserve the family name, the family line, particularly if you are of the nobility or more so if you are the king, this desire to preserve the family line was a very intense motivation which would drive a person to do just about anything to preserve it. And King Saul really went to the limit and beyond to preserve his family line by getting rid of David, which he thought was the encumbrance to it. Verse 18 of Job chapter 18, he shall be driven, again referring to the wicked, when he is brought to judgment, he shall be driven from light into darkness and chased out of the world. Was it not in exactly this way that Christ was hurried out of respectable society to Golgotha and then unceremoniously crucified? So really, if you look at verse 18 in a deeper context, it is a depiction of the fact that Christ really had to suffer the shame, the ignominy, the humiliation of this unrepentant sinner. He had to go to the uttermost in order to save you and I. Verse 19, he, the unrepentant sinner, shall neither have son nor nephew among his people, nor any remaining in his dwelling. These are the words of Bildad. Applied to Job, it was superficially true because Job had but recently lost all of his children. So really, it would have been very painful for Job to hear Bildad saying this. No doubt, Bildad was saying it in general, but obviously the arrow was intended for Job. You will have no son or nephew, no son, no descendant among your people, nor any remaining in your dwellings, which is true of Job, apart from four servants and his wife and himself. His entire household was wiped out. So really, we can hit at a person directly, which is usually an open criticism, which is generally easier to bear. And there is the subtle attack, which is far more stinging, far more painful, because it drives deep into the heart. And this is what friend Bildad has been doing to Job. Verse 20, they that come after him, the unrepentant sinner, shall be astonished at his day as they that went before him were affrighted. Meaning to say, those people who at a future time look back on the history of a wicked man, they, like the contemporaries of the wicked man, shall be struck with shock and horror at seeing the plight of that wicked man. So all of this, verses 7 through 20, the body of the argument is, if you strip Job out of the picture, this argument, the depiction of what awaits the unrepentant sinner, that basically the unrepentant sinner will never get away with it, is technically correct. You can't fault Bildad for that. But the motivation and the object of giving this depiction was very wrong, because it was directed at the person who least deserved it, that is Job himself. And then Bildad comes to his grand conclusion. Surely such, verse 21, are the dwellings of the wicked, and this is the place of him that knoweth not God. What are the closing observations that we can make? They are as follows. There are five closing observations. First, we saw that the conclusion of Bildad's denunciation must have hurt Job exceedingly much, as indeed did the rest of that speech. The more so because it could literally, if you didn't know the reason why Job was suffering, what Bildad said could literally be applied to Job. The fact that it was not true, it was way off the mark, that fact, as we know, was hidden from Bildad and his two companions. The next observation that we need to make is this. The concepts of suffering and of righteousness as embraced by the three friends were legalistic and not evangelical. This is an important point. Evangelical meaning with the understanding of the doctrine of grace. They obviously never had even an inkling of it. So really they were robbed of much peace and comfort and joy that we experience today and we take for granted. But for them, the concept of suffering and of righteousness tended to be legalistic and not evangelical. That being the case, they could not comprehend, not even Job, they could not comprehend that God, in the exercise of his sovereignty, does sometimes ordain affliction and suffering even for the righteous. Fourthly, the righteousness of Job was not that of mere conformity to the law, but rather of a nature, a disposition that was directed wholeheartedly towards God, and of conduct, a lifestyle that proceeded from faith. In other words, Job really was the picture of a truly godly person. And this is the important point for us to note with a fuller revelation of Scripture. This picture, this image of the righteous man, even standing firm, even in the midst of untold suffering, this picture is really the picture of Christ. I am not saying that Job is a type of Christ, because I do not believe that we can substantiate that claim. But Job, like every true believer, carries in him as a righteous man the image of Christ, and in so doing he points us who read about him to Christ. With that we conclude chapter 18.